Welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 2, Episode 4. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
And this episode is sponsored by the Poirier Group. Steve, I've really been looking forward to this episode. I love talking about returns, as funny as that sounds. And I was joking off, Mike, maybe we should call this episode Many Happy Returns. But in my experience, you know, while returns can be a retailer's nemesis, a return process well done is brand elevating and a customer relationship building. But it's complex, right?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, I think you and I have been dealing with returns and exchange issues for probably as long as we've been in retail. And there are just a lot of categories that have high rates. We've kind of created this monster of making it so easy to do returns, but it drives a lot of cost. But you're right. I mean, there's a real opportunity for retailers to delight customers by handling them. But you know, it's this age old issue. You know, on the one hand, you want to work on the root cause of the returns, right? Like if the reason for the returns is bad packaging or poor fit or poor quality or whatever, like that certainly is something you want to root out as much as possible. But to the extent they're inevitable, just because not everything's going to work out or customers buy multiple versions of the same thing, then you want to make it as easy a process as possible, and then try to figure out, as we talk about in the episode, what's the best way to make that fast, easy, and hopefully less expensive for the retailer.
Yeah, and my experience has been the more you focus on it, the more you discover that you're in control as a retailer more than you think. In other words, as you were saying, you know, if you can reduce elements, and that could start right on the website if we're talking about an online return, good picture, great description, great fit size. So you can do many things that will meaningfully both enhance the customer experience and reduce return, because they're both a nice mutual win for both you and your customers.
It can be, you know, a lot of times, and I know this has come up a few times on the podcast so far, as I often advise clients to think about the whole customer journey as a way to unlock opportunities, to take out pain points and create a wow experience. A lot of times, I'm not sure retailers think as much as they should about the return process. You know, it tends to be more website conversion or in-store experience or what have you. But it's a big opportunity, yeah, and it really requires you to go through there and dissect each part to understand where the opportunities are.
Now, in your history, from a strategic perspective, I've always been on this edge, knife's edge of, you make it too hard to return and you kind of potentially could reduce your conversion rate. People are like, forget it, I'm not going to return it. Alternatively, if you make it too easy, then you've got, you know, too high returns, and it just seems like a good thing to do, an easy thing to do. Where do you sit on that? Like, where's that fine balancing point?
Well, I think it is complicated. One of the things which is starting, I guess, to get more attention is to really see if you can steer clear of a one-size-fits-all policy. Now, that doesn't always work well with the lawyers or what you say on the website. But clearly, there are some customer relationships that are so valuable that you don't necessarily mind, particularly that they return at a high rate, because overall, it's going to work out for you. Then on the other hand, you've got customers that really abuse the policy, or as we touch on a little bit in the interview, that basically are renting the product, even though it looks like they bought it. So I think there's a nuanced view. And fortunately, there's some technology that's starting to come out to try to track down these serial abusers, or at least make it easier to analyze what the root drivers are.
The good thing about e-commerce, of course, is you know who ordered it, and you can kind of track and index their return rate. So it does get you past, you know, the known unknown, so to speak, of mass people just returning and not attached to an individual. And as you say, there's some technology coming out about that. You know, why don't we just jump into our first interview, because we're talking with Scott Wingo, and he's coined this term Returnageddon. And really, it's the culmination of many things as the COVID era brings, but it's this increase of pace of returns for a whole bunch of reasons. So let's have a listen to that.
Well, we're excited to welcome Scott Wingo to the Remarkable Retail Podcast. Scott, our custom is to always start by asking the guest to tell us a little bit about themselves and the work they do.
Hey, Steve and Michael, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm Scott Wingo, and I am a serial entrepreneur from the Research Triangle Park area. Most relevant to your listeners, I started a company called Channel Advisor in 2001. So it's been 20 years. So it seems like just yesterday, but time flies when you're doing startup-y stuff. And the general idea of Channel Advisor was that, you know, we believed there was all these companies focused on creating your websites. We all know and love Shopify, Magento. At that time, they didn't exist, but there was a bunch of another set. And we thought, you know, no one's really solving this problem of what if you start to sell things off of your website across the internet at areas like marketplaces, comparison shopping engines, et cetera. So that's Channel Advisor and what we started. And the short story there is started 2001, raised about $90 million in venture capital, went public in 2013. And then after a couple of years of running a public company, I kicked myself upstairs to the board and started a new company called Spiffy, and that's on-demand car care.
Excellent. And you're also the co-host of what many people are saying is the second best retail podcast. Do you want to just mention that briefly?
Sure. Always fun to be on another podcast. I feel like I'm cheating on Jason a little bit, but he does it plenty of times. The genesis of that was I was on the board of shop.org, which is kind of the digital area of NRF. And there was this guy I got along with really well, Jason Goldberg. He is a stores, payments, grocery guy, and I am an e-commerce marketplace guy. And we would go and, you know, have a dinner or drink after these meetings. And I off the cuff said about 5 years ago, hey, we should do a podcast because I learned so much about payments from you. You seem to learn about marketplaces from me. That would be interesting for people to kind of listen in. And the next day, a mic arrived, and we've been doing, I think we just crossed 250 weekly episodes. So
wow, congratulations.
Been doing that for a while. Yeah.
Congratulations. That's fantastic. Yeah, it's a great podcast. Jason's been on both our, both Remarkable Retail and my other podcast, The Voice of Retail. So fellow podcaster, that 250, that's very remarkable in and of itself.
Well, actually, it ties a little bit to your podcast. So one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on was certainly the great industry background you have and all the insights you have on all things retail and e-commerce. But in particular, you and Jason started talking about this term Shipageddon, which then morphed into Returnageddon. But maybe you could just start with telling us a little bit about what Shipageddon was about, and then we'll shift the conversation to returns.
It started when Amazon launched their DSP program, which is delivery service providers. Started looking at that. It was kind of interesting. It's kind of like, why is Amazon doing this? And as I dug into that, I heard from some people that used to be at Amazon, people at Amazon would never tell you this, that Amazon had done the calculus, and they essentially looked and they saw, you know, if you charted out the lines of USPS, which is not really adding capacity, and then you've got UPS and FedEx, they're growing at about 10% or 8 to 10%. And then you have e-commerce growing at 15%. Amazon has like half of e-commerce. Amazon could look at that data and they could see a day where they would use all the available capacity to deliver stuff. So they started hedging that and building their own direct-to-consumer thing. So then the pandemic hit, and Jason and I are kind of openly just discussing, you know, if Amazon saw that, then, you know, what's it going to happen? We're in this elevated period of a pandemic where we went from 15% growth to like 45% growth in that Q2 of 2020. How much capacity is there? And we started doing some back of the napkin math, and it felt like we were at capacity by like August. So then it was pretty obvious to then say, well, when we have the normal surge of the holiday, what's going to happen? I don't think anyone's really thought this out. And then, interestingly enough, sure enough, right then, you know, almost a week later, we started to see FedEx and UPS like really do some weird things, like having weird conversations with people. I think they had done the math around the same time. And thus Shipageddon was born. So the general concept was that, you know, the available capacity to ship products is really maxed out generally right now. And then you had a pandemic and holiday, and it gets past 100%.
Now, the other side of that is a part that this episode's about, and that I actually spent a lot of time focusing on in my career, which is reverse logistics, the returns part.
Yeah, and I'm a software guy and not a traditional retailer, so I've had to kind of learn a lot of this stuff that you guys intuitively know. And I wasn't really returns weren't really on my radar until at Channel Advisor. You know, part of what Channel Advisor does is we help retailers open up new channels, and it's great, and it streamlines things and creates a lot of sales. But one of the only negatives is now you have even a bigger returns problem, because now you have these separate flows of reverse logistics, right? So let's say you're a mythical retailer and we get you to sell on eBay, Amazon, Walmart's marketplace, and then maybe like, I don't know, Etsy or something. You know, one of the unintended consequences of that is now you have an Amazon way of handling returns, an eBay way of handling returns, obviously your website still, maybe even store, and then, you know, and then Etsy, et cetera. So, so that's when it first came on my radar. And, you know, we did pretty, what I would call kind of a software solution. So we would just try to normalize it. So at least when a return came by, it was a generic channel advisor return, meaning from another channel. And then inside of there, if you wanted to pick it apart, you could tell, okay, it's an Amazon one or not. Then it got even more complicated when Amazon launched FBA, because then you had this whole, you know, if it was an FBA order, it was handled different than if you fulfilled it. So that was kind of my entree into the world of returns. And then, you know, when we started talking about Shipageddon, it's funny, I went ahead and bought the domain name for Returnageddon because, you know, when you model out Shipageddon, you know, there's like 8 to 10 million packages that didn't make it by 12/25, 2020. So then, you know, now it's going to take like another 2 weeks for those packages to work through. Well, returns, they don't wait for that, right? So, you know, 12/26, the returns start coming back. So then this whole supply chain, you know, if the forward side is slammed, the reverse side is going to be doubly slammed. So that was the kind of tongue in cheek reason for Returnagain.
So once you kind of put that out into the universe, so to speak, via the podcast, I mean, it generated a lot of buzz. Did you get any feedback from the retail industry or from the players that they say, yeah, you nailed it? And you know, what was the feedback?
Yeah, we definitely nailed Shipageddon, or I should say I did. Jason thought it was going to impact big companies more. And I was kind of like, that doesn't make logical sense to me, because they can go and they can say to FedEx, look, I spend $8 million shipping stuff with you. You're going to give me capacity.
And they're a little better place to absorb the shipping premiums, right? These surge capacity surcharges that are now still in place, actually, I think, which is boggling some retailers' minds, is we're well past peak, as we used to call it. But you're still getting surcharges for volumes. It's a bit wacky, right?
Yeah. When do surcharges become prices? I don't know. Yeah. At some point that they're the same. My theory was it was going to be the small seller, because, you know, at ChannelAdvisor, we deal with these folks. They largely rely on USPS. You know, USPS had no prep or no ability to know what was going on. And they took all the packages FedEx and UPS wouldn't take too. So they ended up being like, you know, the real problem, the bad chain in the link, if you will, link in the chain. And yeah, so it was the small business. So I think we nailed that. And the small businesses were just like really frustrated, and they had upset customers. And so USPS got so far behind, they wouldn't even like, you know, scan the packages. So the packages were stuck in this limbo state of the retailer thought they had been put in the system, but USPS, you know, hadn't. So then you call the retailer, and the retailer's kind of like, you know, ma'am, I know it looks like we haven't shipped it, but we have. Yeah, right. You're in this like really, really hard place as a customer service person with that.
Do you think that around Shipageddon and then Returnageddon, so to speak, that I've described curbside and store returns as a safety valve? Do you see it that way as well?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's interesting because for the longest time, those of us, and I'm guilty as charged, in e-commerce have beat up folks that, you know, you get this boat anchor around your neck, you old store guys. Steve gets a lot of this heat on Twitter on the regular basis. You know, we would jokingly say to people, wow, you built all those stores and, you know, wow, they're kind of useless. And then, you know, then the store guys did ship from store and you're like, okay, that's smart. And then, you know, I think, you know, with COVID, the stores were the saving grace for a lot of those folks. So Amazon won by having their direct channel to the consumers. The people that were really hurt were pure plays that didn't have stores and weren't Amazon. So that they were really kind of, you know, the path from them to the consumer was really hard. And then if you had an omni-channel or harmonized or whatever you guys want to call it, you know, store and digital, it was a good way for customers to still be able to not only buy stuff, but return it.
So at some point, Scott, as I recall, you're a bit of a Star Wars geek. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
So I did write something a while back called The Stores Strike Back. And I think we could do like a whole Star Wars themed episode perhaps around it. But let's leave that for another day. So with regard to returns in particular, there's an aspect of what I think we've seen which has been coming for a long time. If I go back, and I think Michael's had similar experience, if I go back to even my mail order catalog days, really early in my career, but even more recently with the growth of e-commerce, I think just about every retailer was seeing online returns and exchanges be way higher than store purchases. So it just seemed logical that as online grew, that returns were going to continue to grow. And, you know, obviously the pandemic has caused this huge surge, but isn't a certain amount of this just to be expected? And we also kind of created this monster because so many retailers have made free and easy returns just kind of table stakes for doing business.
We have kind of created it, and you guys would know better than I do if the store return rate is lower than e-commerce. I think if we looked at it, the shot heard around the world in the returns world is the launch of Zappos, right? So they were out there, Tony Hsieh and team, fighting against Amazon, and they said, how do we differentiate? And they offered three 365 returns, which when you buy shoes is really, really a big differentiator because, you know, for example, my wife has a shoe size that can fit three different shoe sizes that are out there. So she commonly from Zappos will order two or three pairs, and it's really a sizing thing for her. So that then started this kind of, that was the, you know, I bet if we charted out, there's this bend in the curve, and Zappos really caused that. And then that made all the other shoe people do it. And then it kind of leaked into apparel to a good degree. And it's largely a fitment thing. Interestingly, I don't think like electronics has that different of a return rate, between online and stores, or, you know, pets or some of the other categories. Mm-hmm. It seems to really be around apparel, and it's the e-commerce folks offering it as a fitment solution, interestingly enough.
Yeah, some of it's a fit issue. Some of it's what we call bracketing. In other words, I'm not sure, like what you described with your wife, I'm not sure if it's a, you know, a four or five, so I'm going to get both. You know, what's interesting is this behavior that organically we would think online returns higher just because you don't get to see, touch, or feel it. But what are you hearing? Are you hearing similar things from through channel advisor type clients, and are they seeing upticks in returns, or what's the latest?
Well, COVID was interesting. So I would say Returnageddon, it was the most returns anyone had ever seen, but it was because it was the biggest holiday season anyone had ever seen. I think it was actually not quite as bad as people expected because the categories, you know, the kind of fashion and apparel category has really been, way underwater due to COVID because people aren't going to events. Everyone's just kind of laying around in their pajamas. I know all three of us are probably wearing our pajamas right now and our yoga pants.
I'm wearing a tux. I'm not a farmer.
Okay.
You know, the other fun thing you mentioned, and it's just what we call, I used to work for the Shopping Channel in Canada, which is basically QVC or HSN. And we had what we called the apparel rental program. You know, those customers would have a special event, get a dress, wear it, return it saying it didn't fit. You know, there's wine stains on it, just kind of nonsense. It's interesting. You mentioned less events going on, so less apparel, but there's also less reason to rent apparel too.
Yeah.
So one thing maybe we can noodle through a little bit is, I think, I mean, obviously we've got this amplification of online shopping that's happened by virtue of the pandemic. And to your point, Scott, the mix of what's being bought online is a little bit different than we've historically expected. But don't you think going forward, unless some things change either in terms of consumer behavior or regulation or technology or something, that under any scenario, online shopping is going to continue to grow? And presumably, at some point, the mix starts to shift back more towards apparel and other categories that are, you know, 25, 30, 35% return rates online. So do you generally agree with that premise? And then are you seeing anything that is really working around the horizon that might really start to deal with the returns issue and all its costs?
I do agree. I think at some point we're going to get past this pandemic and there's all this pent up money. So that's good for all of us because the savings rate is like through the roof because people don't have anything to spend money on. And then people are going to want to go out and do stuff, and they're going to be looking at a a closet that's 18 months old. And I think there's going to be like a, people call it the roaring 20s, if you will. So I do think that's on the horizon. I don't know when is the problem. So that's, I wish for listeners, I could tell you it's going to be this June. That would be my preference, but we'll see. And then, have I seen a solution? It's interesting. I've been in this business for like 20 years and I can remember there's this company called Return By, BUI. And they were a logistics kind of solution. And I went to tour their factory and it was like this $50 million state of the art factory with conveyor belts and everything. And while I was there, I saw three returns go through. And I was like, this is not going to work out well for you guys. And it was like a Barbie with its head off. And it was just like, I'm not. And their whole thing was like, how to like resell them for the
reclaim
maximum.
It. Really we'll put it back together.
And I was like, all right, you got a $5 Barbie and how are you going to put $50 of labor into that thing to put the head back on? But anyway, so I've seen solutions that are kind of like what I would call piecemeal. So I've seen software solutions. I've seen, like consumer solutions. So, kind of like bring your return here, kind of a thing, but then like there's no, and then the third leg I think is important is the logistics piece, because at some point with logistics, you get more, there is an economy of scale. And if you think about it, the whole returns landscape is just spread across everybody. We're all doing our own thing. Everyone has that dirty corner of the warehouse that's the returns area, and no one goes back there for fear of, a 20-year-old, thing kind of attacking you. So, yeah. So I think if someone's going to solve this, you kind of have to take on all three of those. And I'm excited to listen to the other guests because I do hear a lot of buzz. There's been a couple $100 million invested in this space recently. And I do think there's a new generation of vendor with a new approach. So I'm excited to learn more myself about what's going on there and what you guys can surface.
Yeah, it's certainly a hot area, and but it's complicated. I mean, I think Michael and I know have dealt with returns for probably the the bulk of our career. And it's not like there's probably any one silver bullet that's going to attack it, but.
Yeah. And, Amazon, they can have their own, because they're at a certain scale, they can have this massive solution. It's kind of interesting. It seems like logically FedEx and UPS should have solutions for this and maybe they do that I'm not aware of, but just because, since the truck's already in your neighborhood, it's kind of the least expensive way to pick up and return is like when the guy is dropping off the next thing. That's how Amazon does it, right?
It's a tough business though for them to be in, because it assumes a lot that the consumer, it assumes a lot of care the consumer would take to package that return up, right? So the consumer walks to the end of the curb and throws him something that's not in a box or half duct taped up, and then it's a disaster in the back of the truck. So I think they've all assiduously avoided taking returns because it is a specialized thing, and it would just slow them down. I that's probably why they might shy away from it. But listen, it's been great. It's been a great setup and great to kind of open the door on this great discussion, because we could we will and continue to tap into different insights. So thanks for opening the door on us, and congratulations on two great URLs, right? Chipageddon and Returnageddon. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just grabbed a Chipageddon. We'll save that for another podcast.
Yeah. Love it.
Thanks for having me, guys. Right. I really enjoyed the discussion, and look forward to hearing how you guys solve the returns problem.
Give us a few weeks.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Will do. Thanks, guys.
We'll be right back. This episode of the Remarkable Retail Podcast is sponsored by the Poirier Group. Do you want to move faster, streamline your processes, and have larger margins? If you're a retailer in 2021, chances are you do. The Poirier Group's award-winning team of industrial engineers and performance improvement experts specialize in driving results for retailers and grocers across North America. From reducing call center wait times to improving stocking and replenishment processes in warehouses, to seamlessly integrating IT systems and more, they are your trusted partners you need. TPG doesn't just design solutions. They leverage years of actual industry experience to implement them and set you up for long-term sustainable success. Just ask their clients. Over 15 years of business, 100% positive review. Visit thepoiriergroup.com/remarkable to learn more today. Steve, that part that we just listened to that frames it in as much as with the great acceleration, as our friend Carl Boutte would say, greater e-commerce means greater returns.
Yeah, what I think is hard to understand completely is all these different dynamics that are going on, right? The mix of products that are being bought, people's hesitancy to go to the store. It's kind of a particularly noisy world the world of returns right now. So I think as we hopefully start to get out of this COVID era, we'll get a little clearer sense of what trajectory we're on and what are going to be some of those persistent issues.
Well, our next guest, David Sobey from Happy Returns, really is that's the focus of his organization is as it's named, Happy Returns, to kind of solve this square, this circle of returns process that works for everyone. So he's got some great insights around what consumers and customers are expecting and how retailers can deliver it. So let's have a listen.
Well, we're excited to welcome David Sobey, the CEO and co-founder of Happy Returns. David, thanks for joining us. And I wonder if we could just start out with you telling us just a bit about yourself and the work you do at Happy Returns.
Well, first, thanks for having me. Excited to be here today. So I'm the co-founder and CEO of Happy Returns. My whole career has been in e-commerce, and I've been at this for about 5.5 years. And as you probably can guess from our name, we are tackling the painful challenge of returning products purchased online. We describe ourselves as a return software and reverse logistics company that is really the operating system for e-commerce returns. And so what we mean by the operating system is we provide return portal software for merchant websites connected to a nationwide drop-off network, 2,600 return bars, which are physical places where shoppers can return products box-free in person. And then the reverse logistics to actually get the items back from those drop-off points to the merchant's warehouse or to the merchant's 3PL. In our case, it taking the form of two processing hubs. So we have an East Coast hub and a West Coast hub, and those two hubs support the 2,600 spokes in our network, or the 2,600 drop-off points. Those three things working together, and then, of course, the brand Happy Returns, trying to build some recognition and some brand equity in the idea of solving what is, for many people, the worst part of shopping online.
Can you just give us your sense, kind of big picture, why you see returns as such a big opportunity for the retail industry?
Yeah, I think it comes down to the shopper experience and the impact it can have on shopper lifetime value at a merchant, and then how important this is to making money and profitability. From a customer perspective, returns are just they are a part of shopping online. I think there are a lot of limitations when you're buying something, online versus in person. Pretty common to have return rates 3 to 4 times higher in e-commerce than in brick and mortar stores. What I think maybe is underappreciated is how important returns are to the whole customer journey. There's all kinds of data that suggests that whether or not you anticipate there to be a return has a really important, it's a deciding factor on whether you're even willing to buy something online or not. It has a huge impact on conversion rate. I think the number is something like 85% of people read a retailer's return policy before checking out. What are they trying to do? Well, they're trying to figure out how painful will this be if it doesn't work out. And then huge impact on customer retention. I think, again, the number is like north of 80% of people say that they won't shop again from a merchant if they have a bad return experience. And so if you think about it from a customer journey perspective, it impacts whether or not someone shops online, it impacts whether or not they check out at the merchant's website, and then huge impact on whether they ever buy again from that merchant. So really important from the customer perspective. From a merchant perspective, huge impact on profitability. And I think this trend is, I'm old enough to remember when free shipping was a perk in e-commerce. Now it's table stakes. And I think free returns is kind of following that same path where, shoppers expect returns to be free. We all know that they're not free. It just means that the retailer has to subsidize them. And so in an environment where, returns are free, really having your arms around the cost and the cost of that subsidy is important. And what's taken place in the last 5 years, but really accelerated in the last year due to COVID is just more expensive shipping. And with logistics costs, going up, the idea of providing a free return option via the mail has just gotten, almost impossible for retailers to manage and still, have a hope to be profitable. So that's kind of where we fit in is trying to help them not only on the customer side, but also on the cost side of returns.
So what are you seeing? Like, are we seeing this kind of two-phase problem or two-prong issue? One is just organically there's more sold online, therefore there's more coming back. Is that panning out? And two, is there this return again? In other words, this pent-up demand, people are holding it longer, maybe they can't get to the store.
Yeah, so I think where the conversation started, we are finding to be true, meaning, you know, more e-commerce means more returns. So we just came off of our best return season ever. December return volume at Happy Returns was up, you know, 50% versus November 2020. So, you know, massive increase. And in our business, you know, there are a number of reasons why. But I think that this idea of more online shopping means more returns is definitely proving to be true. That said, I think, you know, we work with all kinds of merchants, but have a core focus on apparel and footwear. Hmm. And what's interesting is that, you know, when I peel back the layers on our growth, you know, and I look at some of the merchants that we've worked with for a long time, that sort of rising tide of e-commerce adoption and you know, due to COVID didn't impact all retailers equally. Especially, you know, folks that sell higher end fashion. You know, you don't need a high end pair of heels if you're not going out anywhere, right? Or you don't need, you know, a dress if there's, if you're wearing a dress to an event and there are no events because of COVID, you know. And so I think that for some of our core merchants, they were actually down year over year despite this push to more e-commerce. So where we sit, you know, obviously we provide, you know, in-person returns versus the mail. Right. You know, one of the really interesting trends we've seen is a much higher adoption of in-person, which is kind of counterintuitive if you think about it. You know, it's the very idea of being in person seems like it would have more risk in this environment. But what we found is that, you know, for a lot of people, the very act of returning by mail involves a few steps and a time lag that they're not willing to undertake right now. So starting with printing, a lot of people have access to printers at the office and not at home. And so the idea of saying a return process that starts with print a label and put
print
it in
a
mail,
yeah,
it's just hard to do, right? If your printer is at the office and you're not going to the office, that's a harder task than normal. And then the other is, I think people are really concerned about shipping times right now. You know, the idea is, if I put this return in the mail and I send it back to you, how long is it actually going to take to get to you? And then when it gets to your warehouse, like, how long is it going to take for it to be, for my box to be opened and to get my refund back? So we've actually seen higher adoption rates of you know, in-person drop-off to our network than any other time that we believe, you know, is sort of driven by this idea of, you know, man, I just don't have access to a printer and I don't want to wait, you know, that uncertainty, you know, and I think we all have experienced this on the front end, on the outbound side. You know, like I bought something in the spring and it took months for it to get to me.
Right.
You know, I think everyone's kind of mentally doing that on the reverse side, saying if I ship this off, who knows how long it's going to take via carrier to get back to the merchant. So I think those things are factoring in our case to seeing higher adoption of in-person.
And just one thing, did I hear it right that you can buy an item and when you return it to your physical locations, you don't need the original box or packaging? Do you have to package it up? Like you don't just drop it in a shoebox. Just tell me a little bit about that, because that's another barrier, right, to shipping things back in the mail.
Yeah. So we are and have been since the beginning completely box free. So the way Happy Returns works is you start online on the merchant's website. There's typically a return portal that's powered by our software. You identify the item you're returning and we present you with options. You know, yes, you can mail it back if you want to print a label and deal with that, you know, get a box, et cetera. Or you can get a QR code and drop it at a Happy Returns location. And in doing that, you don't need to prepare anything. You just bring your QR code and the item in person. So it's, you know, printerless, it's box free. You know, you simply scan the QR code, they'll check the item in. And then when the items are checked in, that's what triggers the refund with the merchant, or that's what triggers the exchange order if you're doing an exchange. And so it's you know, the easy way to think about it is, you know, buy online, return to store, but for retailers without stores. And so the store, you know, Happy Returns and our locations provide essentially the store in that equation, meaning a place to drop your items off, you know, a place to check your items in, and importantly, you know, the triggering of the refund or exchange.
You know, part of what you were getting at was there are a lot of complicated underlying reasons that we've seen for years that cause high return rates cause extra costs for the retailer. Just going back for a second in terms of what's going on in COVID right now, how much of what we're seeing do you think is just kind of noise that's going to exist in the system for, you know, who knows, another 6 months or so? And how much is really just this underlying reality of the growing returns and exchanges? Because as you said earlier, we've made it incredibly easy, right? We've created this monster as a retail industry to a certain degree.
Yeah. I mean, I think e-commerce adoption is a one-way street. I don't think people are going to go back to, you know, if they've been able to buy things online and had the convenience and speed of that, I don't think, you know, that all of a sudden we're going to see e-commerce decline, for example, in the future. You know, with regard to the return in exchange challenge, I mean, we believe that, you know, until technology comes out that changes the reasons why people return, or until, you know, perhaps there's some AR, VR innovation that, you know, hasn't happened yet that makes it easy to try things on. You know, the returns are just part of the experience. And so, you know, the right answer is not to make it more complex and harder to try to reduce, you know, returns. You know, it's really to just embrace it and say, hey, this is part of shopping online. And because it has this impact on customer lifetime value, that, you know, what merchants should be focused on is not making it hard to return, but making it more cost effective for themselves to subsidize it. And so, you know, we didn't talk a whole lot about this, but, you know, in our model, what happens when the items get dropped off at one of our 2,600 return bar locations is that they get aggregated with the returns from other merchants that we work with. So picture one tote that's filling up all day with returns, you know, so a specific return bar might take in 20 different returns today from 20 different merchants. They're all going to travel together in a commingled aggregated shipment from the drop-off point to the processing hub. So everyone's getting the benefit of aggregation there and driving down the shipping cost per unit. At the processing hub, we sort by merchant, you know, we palletize and we ship in bulk back to either the merchant's warehouse or the merchant's 3PL. And so again, by using aggregation and the simple physics of multiple items in the box rather than individual shipments, we're able to save on the cost. So that's kind of step one in terms of addressing this problem, is not let's make it harder, but let's make it more cost efficient. Where we're headed, and what's kind of exciting about the returns challenge in general, is that you know, we're touching all these items are passing through our facilities now, and we're having some really interesting conversations with our merchant partners about using those facilities that are handling returns as nodes in the merchant's fulfillment equation. So, you know, I think the days of, you know, if you're competing against Amazon and Amazon has inventory in every state in the nation, you know, that's how they achieve same day or next day shipping. It's not by shipping stuff really fast. It's by having inventory positioned. And so, you know, what we're talking to our merchant partners about is, well, can you accomplish the same thing with your returns and start thinking about your returns as another node in your fulfillment network as a chance to both, you know, decrease your cost because you're cutting a whole leg of shipping out, but also increase the speed in which your customers get items. And so I think that's, you know, I think looking ahead, the idea of reverse logistics married with forward logistics as a way to more thoughtfully, you know, deliver items, I think is definitely what we see in the future. And you know, what I think we're probably most excited about is, you know, going from a cost center and trying to reduce that cost to really starting to think about it more from a profit center when you think about us starting to fulfill orders.
So last quick question for you. One or two tips that retailers should be doing today, if they're not, to help them manage effectively this growth in returns. What are the top two things that when you meet with retailers, you say, if you're not doing these two things, start doing them today?
Yeah, I think the first one, it's going to sound so simple, but just having clarity around your return policy. You know, as I said at the outset, everyone who shops with you online is going to read this policy before they check out. I can't tell you how often I read a return policy and I'm like, I'm in the industry and I don't get it, right? It's like, it's complex. It looks like somebody in your legal team put it together. You know, make it as easy as possible to explain to folks what's going to happen if it doesn't work out. And I think that this kind of goes with people for a long time thinking, well, if I don't talk, you know, if I talk about returns, it somehow suggests that I don't have good products, or I'm not standing behind them, or it's like, just get over that. Like, returns are part of e-commerce. Make it easy for people to understand what their options are, you know, would be my sort of first thought. You know, my second is to just recognize that if shoppers want options. You know, think about the options we give people in outbound shipping, right? You know, do you want it? You know, here's sort of standard shipping. Here's accelerated shipping. You know, maybe you can have it shipped somewhere else for pickup as opposed to your home. Like, people want options in returns as well, right? And one option, you know, hey, you have one option that you can do. I just don't think cuts it anymore. So if you have stores, you know, certainly promote buy online, return to store. You know, if your only option is the mail, I think that, you know, I would really encourage people to think about alternatives. And P.S., you know, obviously we have a vested interest in saying that, but don't believe us. Like, go look at what Amazon is doing. Because if you go to return something on Amazon, what you would find today is four or five different options that are not just put it in the mail. You know, return it to Kohl's, return it to Whole Foods, you know, return it to the UPS store, return it to an Amazon store, return it to an Amazon locker, right? All of those are going to be promoted before the idea of print a label and put it in the mail. Why is that? Well, Amazon understands the same insights that we do, which is that customers want choices, that to tackle the cost side of things, they want customers to bring the items to them. You know, in logistics, it's the idea of getting the first mile free. You know, why is that? Well, because when you make it easy, people are more loyal to you. And when you make something that is as taxing as a return a simple process, people are going to shop more. And so, you know, again, don't believe the company called Happy Returns, but believe the guys in Seattle and look at the approach that they're taking to solve this problem. It's in person, it's box free, it's making it easy for the customer.
Well, thanks, David, so much. It's great to get your perspective on it. I think whether we like it or not, we'll be talking about returns a lot more this year and probably for years to come, just part of the whole retail equation. So thanks so much for joining us.
Terrific. Thanks for having me.
All right, well, we're back with our remarkable or forgettable segment, the very popular segment that we've introduced this year in season two, Steve. We've got a number of stories. Let's start with Five Below. They're opening up 170 to 180 stores. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure how many folks even know about Five Below because they've kind of come out of nowhere, but they're almost up to 1,000 stores now, or over 1,000 stores, and I think they're running at about $3 billion. But they just announced plans to open 170 to 180 new stores this year. And I don't know if this is really remarkable in that I think you and I have discussed many, many times that physical retail's still not dead, and we're seeing lots of people open stores. But this is certainly a pretty bold move in the face of the pandemic and the general everything going to e-commerce narrative.
All right, Poshmark is going to the dogs. What's going on there?
So folks may be familiar with Poshmark, one of several resale secondhand clothing companies. They made a big splash last month with their IPO. Valuations gone up, I think it's doubled or something in its first few weeks. But they announced this week that they are going to be doing resale of pet-related items. And I'm going to put this more on the forgettable side. I think it's certainly interesting and logical for companies to look at adjacent categories. Poshmark's already acquired these customers. And so what else can they work with these clients on? And pets are logical. But
pet categories on fire. The pet categories on fire.
It is.
Right?
But, you know, the reason why I think it's forgettable is in the scheme of things, this is a very minor category. I don't think it's an obvious resale category in the way that apparel and accessory fashion is. So interesting, but I think ultimately we're not going to be talking about this one next year.
You know, I'm really interested by watching and observing how the marketplace is becoming so big, and FBA fulfillment by Amazon. Thrasio and Branded raise huge amounts of money. What is going on there?
Yeah, this is really just hitting my radar screen. I wasn't paying very much attention to these two companies, but Thrasio raised $750 million on top of a couple hundred million, I think they raised end of last year maybe, and Branded raised $150 million. And what these guys are doing is a roll-up of these Amazon resellers, really trying to consolidate them and, I guess, leverage scale and scope. So a lot of interest in this category. And yeah, if you look at what's going on and has been going on at Amazon, the marketplace and fulfilled by Amazon piece of their business is, according to the last earnings release about 62% of their total gross merchandise volume and is growing faster than the so-called core retail part of Amazon. So very interesting dynamics. I think it'll be really interesting to watch what's happening here, both in terms of the overall growth of Marketplace and its contribution to Amazon earnings, but in particular, what Thrasio and Branded have up their sleeves. But they've got a lot of fresh powder now to go after these acquisitions.
Walmart put out their earnings, and they were somewhat underwhelming. I think they're starting to run into some limits on growth.
Well, I certainly wouldn't put their earnings in the remarkable category. I think we are seeing some things that are probably pretty expected, which is there's a lot of cost associated with the investments they're making. The shift from brick and mortar to online is not necessarily and probably not accretive to earnings. So I don't think that's particularly interesting one way or another. Is pretty much what's to be expected. What's going to be interesting going forward as they start to anniversary numbers from last year, you know, where they were so tilted by people stocking up, the shift to grocery from eating out, the move to consolidate trips. I mean, a lot of that benefited Walmart and Target and some others. And presumably, as we start to come out of COVID, we'll revert a little bit more to the mean.
Sephora Inclusive Incubator.
Yeah, Sephora's got this incubator program, and they just announced that all of the new entrants are going to be focused on the so-called BIPOC. Not that we need another acronym, but if people aren't familiar, that stands for Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. And so all the brands that are in there are founded and led by diverse founders and management teams. And I mean, I guess this shouldn't be remarkable at one level, because I think this kind of thing is probably long overdue. And certainly the emphasis on better representation is very important. But I would commend Sephora for continuing to take a leadership role on the diversity, equity, and inclusion front.
Let's talk about the January results for retail in the U.S., up 5.3%. 5.3% up in the month of January. Any thoughts?
Well, two things are going on here. One is there is a bifurcation here, right, where the people of means have more discretionary income to spend and are spending it, perhaps spending it differently, but spending it. There's also been additional government stimulus. So it's not terribly surprising to see this boost. What will be interesting is to see what can be sustained depending upon what government stimulus is forthcoming, just generally how the overall economy starts to bounce back in the second half.
All right. Well, that was this week's Remarkable or Forgettable. Tune in again next week where we take on the top stories in the news. You know, what I liked about David's comments there from our interview was this idea of choice. And I don't think that is something that that retailers may not be thinking enough about, is that perspective of it's not something just to be shuttled around, but think of it in that enhanced, give them as many choices as they have to get it, as they have to return it.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit what I was getting at the outset of, got to be careful these one-size-fits-all approaches, because not every solution is going to work well for every customer. So yeah, I think that's critical.
Well, all right, another great episode, Steve. Read us out.
So if you like what you heard, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and drop us that elusive 5-star rating and tell a friend. I'm Steve Dennis. The expanded and completely revised second edition of my best-selling book, Remarkable Retail, How to Win and Keep Customers in the Age of Disruption, is out in April. Pre-order your copy right now at Amazon or at Indigo or anywhere else you find great books.
And I'm Michael LeBlanc, producer and host of the Voice of Retail podcast. And you can learn more about me on www.meleblanc.co or on LinkedIn. Steve, have a great and safe week.
You too.